right, folks, welcome to another episode of Mention and Dispatches. We are deep into season six. We only got a couple episodes left, and like I mentioned a couple of episodes ago, I got no idea what number we're on. Mike, any idea what episode number we're on at this point? 12,
it feels like
maybe?
It feels like 74.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it's not 2020 anymore, so it shouldn't feel that bad.
No, I really don't. So, I think it probably is about, what, 11 or 12?
Yeah,
season six,
there.
Episode 10, if that means anything.
There you go.
Is that what we're supposed to be?
Well, that was the last one, season six, episode 10.
Yeah, so I think we're actually on 12 then, because we're like recording an extra one ahead. There's another one in between we got to put on there. So the voices you're hearing, you recognize Mike because he's sort of a semi-irregular deputy assistant sub co-host or something like that. So hi, Mike, how you doing?
Hello.
And a podcast rookie, although hardly a Dragoons rookie, our good buddy Brian is joining us from Pittsburgh. How are you, Brian?
Good. I'm glad to be on here. Got me while my speaking fees were cheap.
Yes. We are glad you're on here. Most importantly, BB Mike is going to be horribly outnumbered on this episode. Not just because he's got a pair of relative kids on here with him. He's got a pair of former tankers who are big heavy metal fans.
So
Mike is in trouble.
How do I listen?
Not only that, but somehow, despite being 600-ish miles apart, we both managed to live in a neighborhood called North Hills. So,
I give
really
up.
I'm sure how we
I'm
that
signing
out.
Off now. Good night.
Yeah. You know, look, the last couple of shows, you know, we've had some specific discussions with specific guests about things going on, whether we were talking about the upcoming Connections Online conference or, you know, the students at the Command and General Staff College talking about their wargaming experiences, or the guys talking about teaching game design at the college level. Tonight, we're just goofing off. You know, there is absolutely no agenda. There is no way to sugarcoat this. We're just a couple of dudes talking war games, screwing around, and I hope that's okay with everybody because that's kind of what we do around here.
So. I think this is probably the second time we've done this, right?
Yeah. This week, maybe.
Probably.
Mike, you'd had a couple of games you had ordered last time you were on the show, and I don't know if they had actually landed yet or not. What's the last game that came in the door for you?
That would be Bayonets and Tomahawks, or Tomahawks and Bayonets.
The GMT one.
The GMT one that I forgot I had ordered.
Yeah. So I don't generally do a whole lot of, you know, musket-type games, but that one actually, first of all, it looks really damn good, and it might actually be sort of scaled and thematically appropriate enough that I might actually take the plunge on that. So be curious to see what you think of it.
It's an attractive looking game. I opened it up and looked at it, and yeah, it looks really neat. I'm looking forward to getting that one to the table.
Yeah, I was just looking at that game. You know, at this time in life, I'm trying to budget. You know, I can't buy every darn game that comes out. And
doesn't stop you from trying.
It doesn't start. Exactly. You know, there's so many coming out now. It's crazy. Yeah. That new Gettysburg game just came out today.
That doesn't narrow it down.
Exactly. The one by Flying Pig Games.
I was going to say, the new Gettysburg game is insufficiently, you know, detailed there.
That would be like saying the new Battle of the Bulge game.
That's also a nice looking game too. I was looking at that today because somebody, and I wish they'd quit doing this. They keep posting these things on Tuesday Newsday, and it's just you sit there and like, I did gum it.
So the Herman's game is not my fault because that Kickstarter announcement happened after Tuesday Newsday went live. You got to blame Griffin26 for that because he's the one that posted about that one in the forums.
That is true.
Is not my fault. There are plenty of others that I will happily take the rap for. That's not one of them.
Yeah, the map on that game, you know, typical Rick Barber, if you're familiar with his work on his other Civil War games, it's just a beautiful map. The counters, I'm not exactly enthralled with, but the map is just beautiful.
Yeah, Rick Barber stuff, you'd like frame it and hang it on your wall.
Exactly.
Yeah. No, I'm not exaggerating. I mean, Rick's stuff really does look that good. I mean, it's pretty fantastic artwork. Yeah,
it really does. Any counter that you put on it is, you know,
Is obscuring a masterpiece.
Kind of, yeah.
So Brian, what was the last game in the door for you?
I heard you asking him that question, Mike, that question, and I'm trying to think. You know, I've really kind of tailed off the war game buying to go towards more family-oriented in the hopes of getting the family to actually sit down at the table and play some games with me.
You know, I did say what was the last game in the door. I didn't specify war game.
Well, it's actually Dungeons and Dragons Adventure Begins. It's like a, I guess, a very simplistic dungeon crawl type game. But you know what? I just remembered. I received through the door yesterday the first war game that I ever actually played, you know, going on my nostalgia trip on eBay. And that came from a Strategy and Tactics magazine, 1984 around, I believe. Strategy and Tactics number 103, The Road to Vicksburg. So it's a, you know, obviously has a complete game in every issue. And I'll tell you what, memories started to flood back when I started to go through this. And it has the Battle of Champions Hill in it. And I'll tell you what, some of the, I totally forgot the SPI games got bought out by TSR because I'm seeing all these, you know, TSR actually published this magazine. And TSR, you know, has advertisements in it showing, you know, a bunch of different war games that they put out as well. Just totally forgot about that stuff.
That whole TSR SPI buyout thing still chaps certain people a little too raw because TSR did not honor people's lifetime S&T subscriptions.
I can see how that could be a sore point.
40 years later, there are still people that are upset about that.
Well, what was it? I don't know the whole history behind it. Why the heck did they buy SPI out of all things? I mean, what was their thinking?
We don't have that kind of time. SPI was not making as much money as they probably should have been. And part of that was the fact that they were living in some really expensive New York real estate. And TSR was flush with a whole lot of D&D cash. And I guess they thought SPI would help make them a little more respectable. And
I figured that was part of it. Yeah.
I have no doubt it's way more than just that. Honestly, I'm going to sound like a bit of a shill here, but the Designers and Dragons History of Role Playing actually does talk a bit about the TSR buyout of SPI, not in a huge amount of detail because it's a role playing focused history of gaming, not not hobby gaming as a whole. It's role playing focused. But it does address some of what happened with SPI buying out TSR buying out SPI and kind of, you know, integrating some of those things. You know, the whys, I suppose I could call up Brad Hessel because he lives here in town with me and like get him on the phone. And, hey, Brad, what all happened with this? And, you know, see how much of it he's willing to spill the beans on. But, you know, if you really want to go digging around for it, there's like 12 different versions of the story.
Sure.
As you say, the latest thing in the door for me was actually also an SPI thing, and that is I picked up the copy of City Fight that Aardwolf was selling at his auction last week. And so I got the copy of City Fight from him. And what's cool about it is I think this is a double dose of the counters. It's, you know, one set of rules, one set of scenarios, all that. But there's three counter trays in there, and it is way more counters than my other far more mangled copy of City Fight has in it. And so I think between my two copies of City Fight, I actually have three sets of counters at this point.
that can happen.
Yeah. Yeah. Look, this is not complaining. I am not having a beef with this.
See, I'm looking at it now on my computer. I never even heard of this game, to be honest with you. I'm looking at
City
it.
Fight.
Right. Yeah.
That's dangerous.
City Fight is one of the best. I mean, look, it's 45 years old ish, maybe a little older, and it is still one of the best double blind urban combat games out there. And what's cool is the way the rules are set up. You can play double blind without a referee, sort of the way the spotting rules and everything work out. What's also really interesting, the designer, Steven Donaldson, was colloquially known as Donnie the Punk. big in the punk rock scene. He's got like two, maybe three game designs to his credit. Not very many at all. Huge, huge in the punk rock scene. Major reformer on like, you know, prison behavior and treatment of prisoners and stuff from his time having been in jail for different things. And just a major social activist who happened to design a really good war game on the side. Is kind of how it all worked out. If you go look up that dude's biography, it's fantastic. I mean, he'd make a totally cool sort of Netflix movie, you know, docuseries kind of thing. He'd be a great story to do one on. But yeah, City Fight is the one that was my last one. Before that, I got a copy of Iron Curtain because, you know, I can't help myself. It's Cold War goes hot kind of thing. And so Uncle Sam's stimulus money helped support the local game store. And I bought
there you
a copy
go. Of Iron Curtain. Yeah. Well, did you know there was a computer version of City Fight?
I knew there was an attempt at a computer adaptation, but I have no idea how good or bad it is.
Well, it looks atrocious, but almost every war game on the computer back in 1986 or whatever looked pretty atrocious. So
that would be interesting to check out. See, Mike, you're like reviewing old classic war game stuff for My Own Worst Enemy. Like, you know, dig that one up. Let us know.
If I ever get off, that would be nice.
Also in the Strategy and Tactics magazine, obviously some of the advertisements, Game Designers Workshop, their double blind system, if you remember that. I forget, Operation Market Guard in Normandy, and they had a desert one that I never played. I do believe Crusader. Yes, exactly. They did. I do recall playing the Market Garden one. And what else we got? Okay. Oh, SSI, obviously, you know, for computers, you know.
Yep. Those newfangled computer things.
I'll tell you what, I spent a lot of time at my friend's house just playing on his Apple, whatever the hell Apple it was back then, one of the first, and played a lot of SSI games.
2E or a 2C, because there were only like three games for the Mac at that point.
Yes.
And the 2GS, I think, was still a couple years down the road.
Yeah, I did a lot of SSI games. And actually, I don't know if you remember the Napoleonic Battles one that they had. And I still, to this day, think that was one of the greatest computer Napoleon warfare games ever made.
I remember it existed. I never played it. So I will defer to your expertise there. The other stuff that I just recently got through the door, this is slightly morbid, but I will share it. So about 2 years ago or so, a good buddy of mine passed away, lost his battle with leukemia. I'd posted about it some in our forums. John was a bit of a nut job. The dude had been medically disqualified from joining the Army because of asthma. He ended up as a defense contractor and still spent four trips downrange in the middle of the Guad. And like, you can't make contractors go downrange. Like, they have to volunteer for it. The dude was medically disqualified from the military and kept volunteering to go back to Iraq and Afghanistan. It just kind of nuts. And, but anyway, his wife was kind of clear. You know, her son's 18, has moved out. John has passed away. She doesn't need the house anymore, the bigger house, and was downsizing and moving to a smaller house. But she called me and said, hey, come get all his old game stuff. Don't need it. You know, son's moved out, didn't want to take it with him. I don't need it. So come get this stuff. And so I have in shrink copies of High Frontier, Castle Ravenloft. I've got a giant stack of HeroScape stuff. So I've got enough terrain to put together, I don't know, probably a 60x60 battlefield easy. You know, and that's with varying levels of actual terrain, not just, you know, with different contour lines in there, not just a giant flat battle space there. There was a giant bag of both D&D and Star Wars minis in there. It was stuff she wasn't going to hang on to. I felt a little weird because, you know, when you get stuff from a buddy, it's like you're just holding on to it for them until they come back for it. And like, that's not him.
Yeah.
So it was, you know, a little morbid, but they did find a good home. I'm going to take care of the game. That's not, you know, that's not really in doubt.
So. Have you played HeroScape before?
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
I've never played it. I don't know if it's the looks kind of turn me off about it. Just the whole, it looks like a beehive type thing going on or whatever. But no, I've never gotten into it.
Mike, did you ever play HeroScape?
No, I have not.
Somewhere along the way. There is a very high toy factor to it. I'm not going to deny that at all. The plastic modular terrain that snaps together actually does a good job of giving you a 3D battlefield, a pretty good 3D battlefield. And it is hex-based. So what's cool about it is that you can use it for other things. So you can use it for regular hex and counter style, you know, if you're swapping in minis for the counters. But, I mean, you can use it for regular wargaming stuff. A lot of people I know used HeroScape terrain for Battletech battles because the Battletech minis – damn near fit in there perfect. You couldn't do it with the Clicky Tech stuff, with the WizKids click-based MechWarrior Dark Age stuff. You couldn't do it with that. But the regular Battletech minis, like the ones that ship with the new Catalyst game boxes, fit the hexes for HeroScape reasonably well. What was cool was all the minis are, you know, pre-painted and they look pretty good. They're not hyper-detailed. Like, you're not counting square buttons to make sure things look perfect. But they look pretty good. And the rules, look, any time you've got Templar Knights up against, you know, Death Robots effects from 2300, you're not really talking about realism. So, you know, there's a dragon floating around the battlefield too, just cause. So we're not talking realism, but the rules were balanced and pretty well nuanced that, you actually had, everybody had some little custom abilities and they were well thought out for what you were trying to do. There was, it wasn't just, you know, like one death squad sort of steamrolling the map or anything there. You really had to pay attention to what you were doing, and the high toy factor appeals well to the kids. So, you know, when I first was buying HeroScape stuff, when you could still get it on the shelf, my son was like 3, you know? And so we'd set up a bunch of stuff and, you know, we'd roll some dice and it was just, you know, dad, son playing around, goofing off some, and it was fun. You know, it was a chance to just do something cool with your kid.
Right.
You know, completely ignoring the actual rules, right? We're just, you know, roll dice and move guys around. And it was a good time. So now I've got a crap ton of it. At some point, I'm going to, like, build this giant HeroScape map on my game table just to do it. and just to say that I've done it once, you know? So we'll see how it goes.
But, well, that kind of segues into one of the things I want to talk about, miniatures in general. And how I don't want
them. Oh, boy.
I don't want them. Okay. This isn't wargaming related as much as it is other games. The hell just hit me on the head? A game just hit me on the head, believe it or not.
I'm going to have to get the record scratch sound effect in there when you say, I don't want them. You know?
But
even his board games don't want him to talk about miniatures. They're trying to tell you something.
Well, the problem is, okay, first off, the miniatures aren't coming. They don't come pre-painted, okay? So it's a time sink to paint the things, as you know, and I'm not an artist. Okay. So I don't want that. I just don't want them. They increase the cost of the game. Just give me a, you know, a nice counter with a picture on it or something. That way I don't have to pay $95 for, you know, these games. It drives me nuts.
Yeah. Well,
I will say
that depends on the games you're buying.
I will say that Hero Forge now, if you go there, you can create your own miniature in 3D, and that you can order those painted now. You will pay for that.
Wow, you get a painted from Hero Forge too?
You can. That's something they just started.
Wow, yeah. That's kind of cool.
And they don't look half bad. I ordered one just to see what it looked like, and it's they're actually pretty nice.
Yeah,
ordered one. Like, you ordered one.
Okay,
how many did you really order?
I ordered two, but
it was like
I
that.
Knew it wasn't just one.
Well, nobody can order just one, right?
Well, I'm talking specifically like the what the hell is the game? The I just put it away in my garage because I got sick of all the space it was taking up. The Lovecraft theme from Fantasy Flight.
Yeah, I was about to say it's anything from Fantasy Flight. Was it the Arkham Horror games?
One of
the
Arkham Horror ones? It was one of the Arkham Horror games where you have to. It's app based, and
yeah.
Thank God it does come with, you know, things other. I tried to use the miniatures at first, but I couldn't even get these things to stick into their bases. I just said, hell with it. And I'm seeing way too many games that are coming out like this with, you know, that are totally miniature based. I just don't want it. I don't have the time to paint them. They don't act. I don't think, you know, unless they're painted, I can see, you know, that bringing something to the game. But, you know, unpainted miniatures,
The high toy factor definitely sells. Fantasy Flight for a while there was one of the worst about loading up boxes with a ton of unpainted miniatures, whether it was Warrior Knights or RuneScape or Tide of Iron. Memoir 44s are also unpainted, but that's not Fantasy Flight. Descent was like that. Doom was like that. I mean, yep. Fantasy Flight gives you a ton of monochromatic plastic in whatever box you've got. But, you know, to go along with the ton of status and situation and, you know, counters and whatever else you need as a part of all that, it's astounding that Fantasy Flight builds their business model around games you need a pool table to play on. and they've stayed in business for 30 years doing it. You know, it's crazy.
Well, this is another one of my gripes. Might as well call this night Gripe Fest.
Sure.
Game sizes, and this is specifically towards a lot of Compass Games products. The map sizes are just getting out of hand. you know, I have a pretty big table here. I want to say it's about 5 foot by 4.5 foot or something like that. You know, nice big square table. This ain't fitting any of those. Specifically, I wanted to say the Vietnam game, the new the new Third World War game that just came out.
The Doomsday one?
The Doomsday one. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I would love to get some of these games on the table, but I literally can't fit them on the table.
Yeah, yeah.
And then if you could you leave them set up for any length of time?
Well, I could, honestly, down here, because I got my own man cave game room. But
well, there you go.
Just too much. And the thing that scares me is some of the reprints, you know, that they're coming out with NATO and Korea from Victory Games.
Yep.
They're redoing those with larger maps, larger counters, and so forth. So I'm just hoping I could fit that on the table, possibly. Who knows?
So are the maps actually not – they're not the usual what we call standard. I guess really not standard, but the 34 by 22. Are they larger than that?
Oh, much. Here, I can give you dimensions of just like the Doomsday one, for example, that came out.
Yeah, there are two different – kinds of standard sizes that you used to get for map sheets based on the size of the paper that was shipped to the printing presses. And so I don't remember the exact terms for the two different sets of sizes. One of them was basically the multiples of an 8.5 by 11 inch sheet of paper, right?
Yeah.
So you got 8.5 by 11, 11 by 17, 17 by 22, and then you can go 22 by 34 as you multiply your way up, and usually that was as big as they would get. You would rarely see 34 by 44 just because of the way the rolls of paper used to ship to the printing presses. And then the other sizes you would get were the ones that were kind of the multiples of 12, and so you'd get the 18 by 24 or the 24 by 36 or 36 by 48, again, based on the size of the rolls that used to ship to the printing presses. Once those printing presses all started getting digitized, and the cutting was less mechanical based and more digital based, where they had the ability to sort of custom trim those things with much smaller equipment at the end of the printing press, you started getting all kinds of crazy sizes because it didn't cost more to do a crazy size like that. You didn't have to put the extra finishing step at the end of the printing press. And yes, I did spend a couple years in the printing press, in the printing business. Why do you ask? You know. So.
Well, here's the Doomsday project. 22 by 34 maps plus 1 8.5 by 11, which I believe is Berlin, that gets kind of attached to the side of it. Now,
but do you need all three of? I think for most of them, you only need one. And it's just if you're setting up a larger campaign or sort of the Uber battle that you actually need to put all three of them together, right?
Well, of course, that's the one you're going to want to play.
Well, yes, Brian, we know. That's what you come to Origins for, and bring it with you, and we'll spread it out across 14.
You know what? That's kind of almost the only place where you're going to be playing this thing. You know, there's actually at Board Game Geek, some guy's playing the Doomsday game, and he showed it on his table. It's literally, you've got to have a dining room table, you know, and a big size one to fit this thing on.
Yeah, so that's why I was asking about the size of these things, because they're still printing in what we call like a standard map size, but it's just you get two and three now, and I've got a few games like that. Cataclysm's kind of like that. It's got two maps if you want to play, or is it three? I can't remember. But if you want to play, you know, the whole world, like you're saying, then you got to have some real estate. And then it's not just the maps, but you have to have everything that goes around the maps. You know?
Right. That's not talking player aids or anything.
Right. So it gets crazy.
I have a 4x6 dining room table up here in the office, up over the garage. You know, it's a small 4-seater dining room table. It's not huge. Seats a family of four comfortably, because that's the one that our family used when I was growing up. That's my game table out here in the office. The problem is I don't always have all 4x6 feet worth to work with, because I've usually got something sort of being temporarily stored on it, and temporarily has air quotes around it, right? You know,
right.
Temporarily being stored on my table at the moment. Right now, some of the corners of the table are being held down by the World at War 85 series, and then a whole bunch of RPG card decks. are what's taking up part of my table. But I still had enough room to put the White Tribe on there. I've got enough room to play a one map city fight game. I've got enough room to play a one map Iron Curtain game. If I'm trying to play like a six map connected giant World at War 85 campaign, man, that ain't fit. It's just not gonna
right.
Yeah. Well,
I'm looking at the Korean War, you know, the old Victory Games Korean War, which Compass Game is redoing, coming out in March here.
I pre-ordered that.
Four map sheets.
Oh, you remembered you pre-ordered it.
I do remember that.
42.5 by 71 overall. That's so crazy. That's nuts, especially when you consider what the original size was, which fit on my table, by the way. So I literally just might not get this game, even though I want it. I just might not get it because there ain't nowhere for me to put it.
Yeah, well, see, that's me with World in Flames. and I finally got it, but it's like, how can I ever play this?
You're going to hang it on a wall is what you're going
to
do.
Gonna have to build
I'm
a
just
shed.
Laughing about a 71-inch mat. Look, I'm 68 inches tall.
Right?
Like, I could fit on that map.
I know.
I mean? So that's just nuts. That's crazy. Pull up the Grognard Sims Death Ride Kursk game and take a look at what the map list is for that one.
What's it called?
Death Ride Kursk by Grognard Sims. And I'm having y'all look because I'm facing away from my computer because the Canes are beating the Panthers with about 2.5 to play here, and I'm hoping they can hang on for the win. So
this is just ridiculous.
War games while watching hockey here. So
well, this is ridiculous. I can't.
That's the one that ships in the crate, right?
There's a map to show you how to set up the maps.
He's not kidding, audience. He's not kidding. I mean, Grognard Sims the games are very, very detailed, very exhaustively researched orders of battle. And I swear to God, that Kursk game, it's like the Battle of Kursk at platoon level. And I really don't think I'm exaggerating. You got to kind of look at the counters to double check me here. But yeah, it's, what is it, like 16 maps?
Oh, well, they're showing the one. Like I said, it's hard to tell. I can't count that high. I got to take off my shoes.
There's a picture that it's not even in inches. It's 2 meters by 1.12 meters. But it's rated an 8.1 on Board Game Geek. So apparently it's a good game.
Yeah. For the two people that have rated it.
For the two people playing it.
Well, it's, you know, again, it's, those are, I don't want to say they're lifestyle games because they're not like ASL where, like, that's all you're going to play for the rest of your life. But they are. They're the games that you get if you want the super hyper detailed version of, you know, a big operational fight like that. I don't want to say that they necessarily compare to OCS because they exist at a different scale. They are more tactical than the operational level of the OCS things. But that's the level of detail that you're signing up for when you go get anything from Grognard Sims. And they're about to do that same level of detail to Normandy. They're in the process of slowly rolling out all the Normandy games that will link together. And you'll have Normandy at about a 1-to-1 scale by the time you lay it all out on your garage floor.
I'm looking at this and the counter density is just crazy. It's as bad as the maps. I mean, it's just stacks upon stacks of counters, and every hex just about has counters in it.
Yeah. And you know, that's one of those things that, like, if that's what you want, you know exactly where to get it, right? It look, if that's not something you want, fine. You know, like, go play what you want. You know, Cyrano and I had this conversation on the phone the other day. If that's what you want to do, go do it. You know, just go play whatever you feel like playing. But if that's the level of detail you're wanting, that's the game to go get. You know, that's go grab the ones from Grognard Sims. I think, I don't recall for sure, but I think that the crate from the Kursk crate, because they ship it in a giant wooden crate, like 14 boxes stacked up in there. I think it's in the Guinness Book of World Records as the largest war game.
I wouldn't be surprised.
It is bigger than World in Flames.
They appear to have a bunch of actually playable. Pacific War island hopping campaign type
games. Not gonna go look.
Yeah, well, these ones only have 4 11 by 17 maps, so that's doable.
That's manageable.
Yeah. Well, I'm not even sure you need to necessarily like link the 11 by 17s. I think what you've got is 4 separate island battles that each fit on 11 by 17 map.
No. This is just for the Iwo Jima.
Okay.
Yeah, each island is 4. It seems it's pretty standard. Each battle is 4 11 by 17s.
Okay, so that's not too bad. I mean, that's a 22 by 34. That's not too bad once you put it together.
All right, yeah. So I'm looking, and World in Flames does hold the Guinness World Record for largest war game.
Okay, so well, I know Grognard Sims was submitting their paperwork at one point.
Yeah, for how long? Yeah, who knows?
This was 2018-ish when that was happening, because Me and John Krantz and like two or three other people ended up submitting documents saying, you know, hey, based on what we know of and the measurements that they've provided and what we know of other things that are available elsewhere, this one is actually the largest in terms of, you know, size and scope and components and whatever else. So they had submitted the paperwork at one point. I don't know how long it takes the Guinness Book to go through their stuff.
Yeah, it could be now because this was from August of 2018 for World in Flames.
Well, let's talk about World in Flames a little bit here. It was when I was in the Army way back when, and very popular game, you know, first of its type that I had really seen of that scope. And I've been keeping tabs on what they've been coming out with. So I bought the World in Flames Final Edition. Okay. Was pretty excited about that. Yeah. Lo and behold, it wasn't
the
final edition.
You fell for that, huh?
I did. Hook, line, and sinker. It wasn't the final edition. Now I have this giant collector's edition right underneath it, holding it up, which I had to get because it had mounted maps, I believe. Yeah. Kind of a sore spot there for me with the final edition thing.
Well, you don't think that the collector's edition is the final edition, do you? Because you're going to be disappointed again.
I'll tell you what, it's the final edition that I'm buying.
There you go.
There's going to be a final collector's edition.
Yeah, and there's a whole other podcast at some point, Brent. We should talk about these games, and you buy this nice game, and then, you know, a couple of years later, here comes the second edition with these little changes. What do you do?
Well, I'll tell you what, World in Flames has changed, obviously, a lot from its, you know, when it came out.
Yeah.
Just as far as counter density, all these expansions, it's kind of almost nuts compared to what it used to be. And I'm not exactly sure it's for the better compared to when it first came out. I mean, more detail, yes, better game. I'm not so sure about that.
Yeah, I think World in Flames, you know, their edition labeling, they took a cue from the band The Who, because how many absolute last and final, oh my God, we're never doing this again, reunion tours did The Who go on over the years? Yeah, yeah. And I think the World in Flames guys have released how many different it's like the Final Fantasy game, video game series, right? If it's Final Fantasy, why are there 14 of them?
There you go.
The Never-Ending Story, Part 2.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, they had the good sense to stop it, too.
Well,
they didn't have the good sense to stop at one, but they did at least stop at two. But yeah, the World in Flames, the crazy thing about World in Flames, like if you compare that latest edition, that last one that you got, to the very first one, they look like completely separate games.
Mm-hmm.
Like if you follow the evolution of them from first edition to second edition to third edition, all the way up to, you know, I don't know, whatever edition we're up to, the sixth collector's final ultimate platinum edition or whatever it is. You know, the reprint. Once you get to that point, you know, if you follow the evolution along, then you can see each of the changes as they've happened, and it's not quite as jarring.
Right.
You know, it's sort of like going back to your hometown after being away for 15 years. Like, everything on Main Street's changed. And if you're there for all 15 years and one store changes every 8 months, it doesn't seem like a big deal. But then you come back after 15 years, like, holy shit, where'd everything go?
Yep.
Mike, your idea of what do we do with all these reprints, that might make for a good podcast topic, but unfortunately, the way to really make that compelling would be to get a couple of the publishers on here and have them explain their rationale to us, and I don't know that they necessarily want to have to publicly admit to any of that.
Well, you know, there's a game right now that's on its third itineration, Robinson Crusoe, okay? I like it because it's solo. And I saw that they just came out with another one, and it's got some pretty nifty stuff on the Kickstarter and so forth. And just to update the game is going to cost 85 euros. And I'm like, well, for 85 euros, I'm getting, of course, miniatures. Got to have the miniatures.
I was about to say, you're going to get the minis with that.
Got to get the minis.
And painted.
And pretty much two books that come with it that, you know, that are actually what I want. I'm not going to pay 85 euros for that. That's it's just nuts.
Now, yeah, some people will sell their current copy at a reduced price and get the reprinted copy. I've seen people do that. So that's one option.
That's too much work.
But if you're lazy like me, you're not going to do that.
I actually did that with a friend of mine that when there was a – it was a Euro game. I don't remember what it was. It might have been Ticket to Ride. There was an expansion that came out that packaged two previous expansions into one box, but then had made some other changes in there. I bought the old expansions from him, and he bought the new box. And I didn't care for the little bit of time we're going to be playing that as a family here. You know, my family isn't so into the weeds about the details that they care about, you know, this particular change in the board layout or something like that, the way that he did. And so that's fine. I picked up, you know, two previous expansions for like $8 each from him, where they retailed at 20 or 25 or whatever. And then he went and bought the snazzy new all-in-one box, and that was cool. Like, I'm fine with it, you know, so I didn't mind picking up the older ones there. I do still have a whole bunch of the old original Mark Walker era Lock and Load World at War stuff that is now been made completely obsolete by the very snazzy and actually readable reprint that the David Heath era Lock and Load has done. It's weird. Like, I don't know that I'm ever going to play the old Mark Walker era Lock and Load, the old Mark Walker era Bauhaus font World at War
right.
series games. I'm just not sure I can bring myself to get rid of them either. Because I've got the original first edition, first printing Eisenbach Gap with the Death of the First Panzer expansion in it. And I've got the first edition printing of Blood and Bridges. And I know I'm never going to get them on the table. I just don't know that I necessarily want to get rid of them, even if somebody made me a ridiculous offer, just because there's a bit of a nostalgia factor to them.
Yeah. Sure. I did buy the latest offering, I believe it, you know, the updated, whatever the heck it was, came in a giant cardboard box, but I still haven't opened yet.
Yeah. The one you could fit one of your kids in.
Yeah.
I have that box. So I don't have the box it came in anymore, but that's what's holding down one corner of my game table right now. The three box stack of World at War 85 with the neoprene mat laying across the top of them all.
I've got that.
So Mike, I take you're a collector too.
Yes, we're all collectors in this hobby, right?
The term is pack rat, right? Yeah. The term is pack rat. That's what you're looking for.
Well, you know, I would say I had the largest war game collection in the North Hills of Pittsburgh, but Jim Werbeneth, as you know him.
Yes.
I've seen pictures of his basement, and, well, I don't come close to that. I thought I had a lot, and then I'm looking at his shelves, and I'm like, holy smokes.
Back when he lived in Norfolk, Virginia, I had the good fortune to have dinner over at Colonel Eric Walter's house one evening. I was in the Tidewater area for some business, and so the good colonel invited me over for dinner, and you know, we had a nice meal and then went downstairs and hung out in his game room for a while. If the Library of Congress ever opens a war game wing, the first person they need to call is him. He's actually posted some pictures on Board Game Geek of the new place. They've moved out of Norfolk. They're further inland now. I don't remember exactly where they are, but basically the third floor of his house is now his war game room. And he's got one of the giant Geek Sheet caliber tables in the middle that's got like 12, you know, separate workstations for gamers around the edges of the table. But the entire third floor of his house is a war game library. And there's got to be 1,700-1,800 different titles in there. Easy. It's pretty ridiculous.
Yeah, we all know people like that.
Yes. I know a couple of them, which is kind of sad. You know, it is funny. Like, anytime my family starts giving me a hard time about, you, why do you have so many games? Here, let me show you a picture.
So I was all, I've been following you on Facebook. You were talking about what's the difference between a sim and a game. Do you remember that conversation you were having with people?
Okay, so that conversation's been going for like 15 years now. James Sterrett and I used to build an entire Origins panel that would run for about 2 hours every summer at the Origins War College. We'd build around just the opening question of what's the difference between a game and a sim. And then we'd get easily 2 hours, usually more, because we'd adjourn to a bar afterwards or something. And we'd get plenty of hours out of that. What was it about it that caught your eye?
Well, it reminds me of one of my first wargaming experiences playing Caesar's Legions by Avalon Hill way back. Okay. late 80s, probably playing it with a friend. And I played as the Germanic tribes. He played as the Romans. And I wound up winning the game. But all he could keep talking about was how many, you know, forces I lost compared to him. And I kept saying, well, who cares? I won the game, you know. I don't care that, you know, I lost, according to you, 120,000 Germans. I won the game.
The Russians lost a whole lot of people in World War II, and they won the game.
This is true.
Yeah.
But it just got me thinking about that.
For folks that might be interested in the redux of the games and sims for, you know, kind of what's the difference there between games and sims, there's on our site, there's a couple of Battle Lab columns that actually reprint from way back when at Grog News from the late aughts when I was still running that site. I actually got James Sterrett to write a column where we each took our usual positions. And of course he's horribly wrong. But I still, you know, in good faith, I went ahead and printed his wrongness. But those Battle Lab columns are available on the site if you go look them up in our archives. I also, some of that games and sims piece is included in the YouTube video that I did on games and sims for training and learning that's over on the Dragoon site. And I promised Brian, I did not pay Brian to, like, you know, feed that into the conversation here. Essentially, games and sims are looking at two different things, really, is what it is. And so when people talk about it's a game, it's not a sim. Well, there are times when it's both.
Right.
Because, you know, a game is like a measure of relative competitiveness. You know, like something's got to be competitive to be a game. You can just go for a jog and, like, who cares? You're going for a jog. But, like, when you actually start timing yourself and putting, you know, measuring yourself against somebody else to see who wins, now you've got a game, you know.
Right.
Whereas a sim is sort of, you know, a measure of the realism and the model's fidelity to real world phenomena. And so, you know, tic-tac-toe is not a sim of anything. It is an attempt at area control, but it's not really trying to simulate anything. It's not until you, like, start shaping those areas like something that realistically represents, you know, regular terrain or something, that you start to increase that model's fidelity toward realism. And so you can have something that is a model with a high level of realistic fidelity and is competitive. And so you now have a game sim hybrid there. And that's, like, that's cool. You know, as our good buddy Cyrano likes to ask, though, you know, to what end are you creating these taxonomic taxonomic differences? Like, why do you care? And there are times when you need to care, whether you're arguing for government funding, right, or trying to draw distinctions around award categories or something. There are times when you need to care. More often than not, it's like, are you having fun playing it? Good, go play
right.
It. Who cares? You know.
Well, in the same vein, you know, here I am. I was stationed in Schweinfurt, Germany, as you know. And I was probably the only 18-year-old PFC in all of Germany who knew almost, thanks to me having played NATO, Third World War, I was the only person, 18-year-old, who probably knew where, you know, the forces were located for the Soviets and for all of NATO, which wasn't a big help, let me tell you, when you're a PFC. But
no. Even if you're a PFC in the S2 shop, it wasn't going to make that much difference.
Right.
Yeah, you probably got to Germany about a year and a half after I left, because, you know, we left in the late 80s after my dad had been stationed there. But one of the things that we always thought was fun was whenever we'd get one of these Cold War goes hot war games in the mid 80s, you know, and they were contemporary games at the time. It wasn't like looking back 35 years. It was, you know,
exactly,
this could happen tomorrow, ripped from the headlines. We'd open them up, and the first thing we'd do is try to find where we lived on the map.
Of course.
That's the first thing you're doing, because I'm sure you're going for Schweinfurt. Hey, there's Schweinfurt.
You know, when I was looking at this guy's Doomsday, you know, playthrough, first thing I'm looking for, how are we doing over in – how's the 1st Brigade 3rd Infantry Division doing over in Schweinfurt?
Yep.
How are we making out down there?
Yeah. How were you making out? Were you getting steamrolled?
No, they held out pretty good. They retreated across the main river, and they were doing all right, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. The, you know, the drive on Giessen campaign in – the World at War, the new World at War 85 box sort of, perked me up a little bit there, because I used to live like 30 miles west of Giessen. And so
right. If
they're driving on Giessen, once they pass Giessen, they're like cruising through the town I used to live in. And, And so now I'm paying attention all of a sudden. Oh,
it's crazy that these games are regaining popularity again.
Yeah. We've talked about it some on previous episodes of the podcast that, you know, sort of various reasons as to why. And I think one of them is just now that we've got access to the sources from the other side of the wall, we can come back around to a lot of things we had designed before and figure out how to improve the accuracy of what we had done. And I think that ultimately makes for a better experience in the game overall. You know, that's my opinion anyway.
And plus it seems like we're about to go through it all again. So,
well, just another, you know, 500 miles further east.
Well, you know what? This spring, a topic I want to talk about is, I don't know if you guys have been keeping track on the Armenia-Azerbaijan war and what's been going on down there.
Swarms of drones.
Warfare is being revolutionized right before our eyes.
Oh, yeah.
And, I mean, you basically – and Armenia didn't – they basically had a Soviet army, you know. They were no pushovers, but this – combined arms thing, you know, Azerbaijan didn't have a great air force, but these drones that they're totally obliterated the Armenians. And yeah. I'm not exactly sure, you know, I have the Next War series, Next War Poland, Taiwan, Korea, whatever. You know what I'm talking about.
Yep.
And I think they've been made obsolete overnight, to be honest with you, as far as anything resulting in, you know, if you want to talk about a simulation,
yeah,
you know, it even makes you think, you know, the Chinese going against Taiwan, what's going to happen now? If I was China, I would just, you know, pretty much start a standoff campaign. And for 2 weeks, just run drones over top of, you know, Taiwan.
Yeah.
I don't know if you saw, there was a news article a couple of weeks ago about, I think it was some of our destroyers off the coast of California, that these drones swarmed them. And they said that they weren't commercial drones because they were in the air way too long to be commercial drones.
Right.
So, and the article, you know, they said they didn't know where these drones came from. And of course it concluded with, well, hopefully it was the Navy doing it themselves and not telling these destroyers, but it kind of made you think, you know, it's like,
Yeah.
So I think you're right. I think there's this whole new, I think we're seeing a revolution in warfare, which I think we've also talked about in previous podcasts.
At least once. You know, or twice or 12 times or so. the terminology I get a kick out of, though, one of the things that I think is hilarious is folks are referring to these things as suicide drones. I'm like, who are you killing?
The drone itself, I guess, is all, you know.
At that point, it's a cruise missile.
That's exactly what it is.
Right? I mean, at that point, what you have is a really tiny little cruise missile, and that was like one of the sort of key plot points in the movie Runaway from 1984, right? with Gene Simmons as the villain. Yeah.
Yes.
You mean there's not little tiny meeples flying those things?
There might be, but again, who are we actually killing that this is a – No, and to me, that's the biggest thing is that the drone technology, right? This is essentially remote control airplane technology. The drone technology, the miniaturization has allowed us to put a decent amount of oomph into small throwaway. I mean, these are essentially guided hand grenades.
Yep.
or miniature cruise missiles, however you feel like describing them. That's what we've made through the combination of miniaturization and mass production to get the price down to where it's economically viable to create these guided hand grenades.
Yeah. Or you could deliver biological agents or, you know, radioactive. So, yeah.
Okay, Goldfinger.
It's scary.
The Azerbaijanis were using full-fledged planes, older planes. I forget which, which ones they were, but basically biplanes and flying them in there.
Yeah, I mean, look, that's what the V1 rockets were, right? I mean, they were essentially dumb fighters, you know.
And the balloons the Japanese sent up, you know, to cross the jet stream, same thing.
But this also affects reconnaissance. I mean, you know, I mean, what's the point of having a armored reconnaissance unit now when you can pretty much send out, you know, a drone mobily and recon better than anything that you could have on the ground? To be honest with you, nowadays, I don't think I would join the army nowadays.
Well, that's because you think the Space Force is just a cool thing to do.
It's well, the main thing is, I think it's just gotten so deadly now to the point where, you know, especially if you're in an armored vehicle now, you're a target, is basically what you are. I think you're safer being an infantryman.
Well, look, this has continued to swing back and forth over the years, hasn't it?
Yes, absolutely. And with anti-tank missiles, you know, that people thought
there were ATGMs, then there was the Trophy Active Defense System. Right. There was, you know, before that we had the RPGs, then we had the RPG cages around the vehicles. There's, you know, we had the Saggers with the wire-guided missiles, and so we taught tankers how to drive, you know, erratically in order to break the wire against the terrain so that they couldn't guide the missile anymore.
Right.
And honestly, I'm kind of regurgitating one of the interludes on tank warfare from the original Hammer Slammers collection of short stories. If you don't believe me, get out the book and look it up. I'm damn near word for word regurgitating one of those interludes about, you know, armored warfare and about how things would this pendulum would swing back and forth. These guided hand grenades, right? These little smart drones, whether they're swarming or not, that's the cool new thing right now. At some point in the next 20 years, somebody's going to develop some sort of active defense mechanism that's going to counteract these things, and the pendulum's going to swing back the other direction. We just don't know what it is yet. Any more than 15 years ago, we knew that swarms of flying hand grenades were going to start overwhelming armored columns.
I bet there's a solution sooner rather than later for these things.
Probably, because the pace of those solutions seems to be.
Especially speedy. If they're swarming our ships.
Yeah. Well, the fun part of it is, you know, sort of how do you, you know, it, as wargamers, how do you build this into a war game?
Yeah.
Well, so that's what we need to do. We need to go to the UN and say, look, let's, all future battles will be resolved in Tabletop Simulator. And that way, you know, it's. You know.
Let me know how it works out for you.
But yeah, it just seems like warfare is becoming. I mean, it's obviously been devastating in the past. It seems we're getting we're on the threshold of a new level of devastation and so forth that can be inflicted on an enemy very impersonally.
It's called the solution to the Fermi paradox.
Yeah, well, that may be. Brian, I think what you've got is you've got the capability for a greater level of destruction, but with it, the capability for more accurate targeting as well. And I think before, where you would have to send out swarms of unguided munitions, right, the DPICM that we always talked about the artillery guys firing, once those rounds release all those bomblets, they're just dumb bomblets, and they're going to land wherever they land.
Sure.
And as opposed to these swarms of small guided drones that now can target that tank, right? Not those other 14 tanks. Fuck that guy in particular, right?
Right.
That one tank is now going away. And so the implications there are, we can really wreck that one tank's day without affecting anything else in the village. That, you know, if we don't want to, and so while we are more destructive, we now have the capability to target much more tightly. And is that going to actually make warfare, while it is more destructive for the participants, does it become less destructive for the bystanders?
And that's a good question.
I don't know the answer to that.
I mean, we're pretty much talking about a low intensity conflict, you know, where who knows what's going to happen in the future as far as that is, how it affects civilian casualties and so forth.
But even a high intensity conflict, like, you know, the Russians had the Germans trapped in Stalingrad, and they wanted the Germans out of Stalingrad, but they wanted the city back also. They didn't want a flat slab of concrete. They ended up with kind of a chunky slab of concrete, but that's not really what they were trying to do.
Right.
If they had a way to eject the Germans without leveling the city, they would have.
Right.
Yeah. So,
but I mean, you can look at the Ukrainian civil war going on. It doesn't seem, you know, the Russians or the separatists, you know, want to keep their area of land, but it's pretty much blown to hell.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't seem anybody really cares what's left there.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the Russians sure don't.
No.
But before we get too far, too much farther gone in the show, I do need to take a moment and, you know, a word from our sponsors, or actually a word for our sponsors, our Patreon supporters that we have committed to recognizing on the podcast by name. our Patreon is live. You can get to it in the little menu bar across our site at armchairdragoons.com, or just go directly to patreon.com/armchairdragoons. We've got three different levels of pledge that you can support the Dragoons with, and we appreciate every bit of support that we can get from folks that help keep us on the air and keep us on the web. But the folks that support us at the higher end of that, we had committed to recognizing by name on every podcast episode. And so Kevin Bertram and Treb Curry and Patrick Garrity and Joseph Knoll, we want to say a special thank you to you guys for supporting us and for keeping the Armchair Dragoons active and present and going. And so thank you very much to those guys. Keep in mind that you don't have to support at the highest possible level to still help out the Dragoons. Folks that support at the mid-tier and up, one of the other benefits you guys get is advanced registration to, you know, Armchair Dragoons events that we do. So when we've got the ACDC coming up this summer, if you're supporting us at the appropriate level, you're going to get first crack at registering for both tickets for the event and for the actual events in the program itself. So that's something that appeals to you. Go take a look and see what you think. With that, the shameless shilling is now over, and we can go back to talking about flying hand grenades.
Let's take it back to gaming here for a second.
Oh, pish.
Mike, I don't know. Do you do a lot of computer war gaming, or are you exclusive?
No, I'm not exclusive. I've been off the computer lately. I've gone back. Went back to strictly board gaming lately, and the computer's kind of fallen to the wayside. Although I'm getting back into computer gaming a little bit more, because I know that I think there's a Warplan Pacific is coming out.
Yes.
And I'm really interested in seeing that. And I've got, what's the other one?
Wait, hold the press. You're interested in a Pacific war game?
I know, crazy, right?
Who saw that coming?
Well, speaking of the original Warplan, I could never figure out what the hell was going on as far as the naval aspects of the game. I found the ground and the air to be very well done. I have no idea what was going on when I was trying to control my fleets and so forth.
Well, let's hope they've straightened that out, because that's kind of important, right?
Well, that was kind of my thought. I'm like, I thought that was by far the weakest point of the game. And being World War II European theater centric, obviously that's not that much of a big a deal. Now, going to the Pacific. Yeah, let's see what happens.
Yeah.
But one of the things about these games is how much complexity is a hindrance in these, especially to an AI. There's this, I don't know if you've been keeping up with the game Grand Tactician Civil War game. It gets down to the point where you're buying rifles for your, you play as the strategic commander of the war, but you're in charge of buying rifles, food, all, stuff like that.
Things that you should be looking at your S4 and saying, S4, go handle this.
Exactly. That's not the only game. I think Hearts of Iron, for a long time, they've added so much crap to it that the AI just literally has no idea what it's doing at this point, especially in the Pacific Theater. Anything resembling the Pacific Theater and Hearts of Iron doesn't exist still to this point, So the question is,
have you checked out what's going on with War in the East 2?
I know of it.
There's a thread going on the Matrix forums that this guy did an inter-theater transfer to bring a handful of divisions from the West Front over to the East Front. So basically he's moving guys from off map, bringing them from France and the Netherlands and whatever, and bringing them over to the East Front, and they all showed up without their trucks. And so he's got like four Panzer divisions with no trucks. And he's like, how the hell do I get the trucks to these guys? Because I can't find any option to equip these guys with trucks. And the answer coming back from the devs is like, we have to go put them off map in garrison mode to allow them to reconstitute. It's like you've got a log officer for a reason, right? You go look at the log officer and you go, fix the goddamn truck problem, or you're fired. And then like you go back to fighting the war and you let that guy fix the truck problem for you.
Well, that's kind of what these people love, though, that play War in the East or War in the East 2. And they love this micromanagement stuff.
Those guys are probably the worst bosses on the planet.
Exactly. Yeah. I remember I played the first one that came out back in, what was it, 94, 95? I forget what it was called back then. It wasn't War in the East back then, but it had troop troops down to the squad level, individual tanks, all in this strategic, you know, East Front thing going on.
Yeah.
And yeah. It really felt like you were just being more of a manager than you were actually using tactics and so forth to, you know, achieve the win. It was more of, you know, who was the better at logistics, so to speak.
Yeah, which actually does kind of matter, you know.
It does. You go to the simulation game thing.
Yeah, yeah. It's amazing how much more effective your tanks fight when they have gas and can go. So.
And there's other games like the I don't know if you've been keeping abreast of the game U-Boat that came in early access last year. Here's a game where you're in charge of putting what's in the refrigerator of the U-Boat, and not just, you know, food, what type of food, you know, pineapples, cheese. I'm thinking to myself, are the designers really doing this? I just want to take the U-boat out and, you know, go across the map and, you know, use strategy and tactics to sink convoys. Yeah, and I don't want to worry about, you know, what type of fruit that I'm putting in the fridge. Just design decisions like that. Mind-boggling.
Yeah. It having been a log officer, right? I was an S4 for a while. It's not fun. I mean, there's a certain point at which – and part of it is that the kinds of things that actually matter on the S4 side of the house are the kinds of things that, quite frankly, got no business being in a game, because there's no real game effect that's being measured as a part of all of this.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll give you an example, and Brian, this one you can probably relate to from having, you know, been out in the field at least once in your life. In the U.S. Army, we've got a certain flow that the logistics system runs on at the battalion and brigade level, where you get your log pack, your logistics package comes by at least once a day, usually twice, usually one in the morning and one in the evening. And in the morning, you send your maintenance paperwork, because you get your maintenance manual for your tank out. You put it on the front slope, even when you're in the field. Like, there's a war going on, doesn't matter. You still got to make sure the tank works. And so you get out your maintenance manual and you're doing all of your checks, your PMCS, preventive maintenance checks and services. And you've got your little form, whether it's, you know, the 5988E was the electronic one. I don't remember what the predecessor that was. I think it was a 2404. You'd sit there and you'd fill out all the paperwork, right? You know, the gunner's seat torn, you know, has a tear in it, and so the padding's coming out of the gunner's seat. Whatever problems you've got. And that goes back with the first sergeant when he takes the log pack back. And so the mechanics take a look at this thing, and they may come out and try and help diagnose the fault, or they may just know, oh, we got to send a replacement gunner's seat out to these guys. And then either that evening or the next morning, here comes your replacement gunner's seat, and you've now got to bolt that thing back in. You can put that kind of log flow into a game if you really want to. Like, some nut job out there thinks that's fun because he's never had to do it for real. And that's cool. Like, you do you, man. But it ain't that much fun. The problem is, okay, if I don't ever repair my ripped gunner's seat, what's the game effect? Like, does my gunner get hemorrhoids and he's less effective? Like, what the hell happens if I don't repair my ripped gunner's seat? What's the game effect of not assessing that properly somewhere in there? You know, that level of detail, sure, you can put it in there, but to what end? Like, what's the point of having it there?
Right. And like, if I don't put enough cheese in the storage locker, my morale of my sailors is going to go down. It's like, I don't know.
Yeah, I could see, you know, like, if this is age of sail, right? If this is the 1720s and you don't pack enough citrus, your entire crew comes down with scurvy and they fight at half power. But do I need to count the number of barrels of limes? And does it matter if they're limes versus oranges? You know, some people.
It's just a matter of how much, aka realism, do you want in the game? How much detail? And like I said, with artificial intelligence nowadays, you got to teach in your game how to use these features that you put into the game. And
yeah.
And most of them just cannot even, you know, have no idea how to deal with them.
Yeah. So look, the issue of sort of maintenance and repair parts was just one very simplistic example of sort of how that log flow works. you've also got not just are you bringing hot meals out to the guys, but if you're bringing hot meals out to the guys, what does that do to your water consumption rate? Because now your cooks are using more water to heat the hot meals to be able to transport those things. If you are transporting hot meals, but there's a problem somewhere along the way and the hot meals don't get to the guys in time, now you've got a potential food contamination issue. You're going to bring knock guys out with food poisoning along the way. So instead, you're now going to ship MREs out there. Oh, but what do you do about the six dudes in your 35-man platoon that happen to be Jewish and need the kosher MREs shipped to them, which come in a completely separate box from a completely separate stockpile from all the rest of the MREs, right? We're just talking about moving food around, and that's like the kind of shit that an S4 cares about when you're trying to plan your battalion logistics plan. Again, you really want this level of detail in your games?
Exactly.
Okay. You know?
By the way, I don't think we had kosher MREs when I was in. I think that's a
they showed up when I was at Fort Irwin in the mid to late 90s is when they started to go up, and everybody wanted them just because they were something different. Yeah, you know? They had like bagel chips in them.
Oh, bagel chips. Ooh.
Oh yeah, they were kind of cool. They were you know, it was different, and so everybody was like, oh, this kind of, so obviously like no pork. But you'd get, you know, again, like bagel chips were in there. That's the one thing that I specifically remember.
Well, while we're on the subject, what is the worst MRE you think?
The omelet.
Yeah, omelet with ham.
Yeah, well, they claimed it was ham.
Well, that is a contender because you could literally turn that thing upside down and drain out all the liquid that was in it it'd take you about 20 minutes to get it all out. Yeah, I'm going to go real old school because I actually got to try some of the first MREs and the ham chicken loaf. It's as bad as it sounds.
I can remember seeing it, not wanting to try it.
Just absolutely awful. Now, the dehydrated pork patty also was terrible, only because you would add water to it, you know, to rehydrate it, but it would never get rehydrated. I don't know.
Now you just got wet and crunchy instead of just crunchy.
Exactly.
But it was pretty bad. You know, the point here was not, you know, trying to get down to the individual MRE level, although of course we certainly can and talk about just how disgusting the country Captain Chicken actually was. And the fact that you will never ever on any menu anywhere in America find something called Country Captain Chicken, but somehow it makes it into the MREs. But again, you know, The level of air quote realism, right? The level of detail that you could put into the games is some of it can be there. And, you know, the infamous pasta rule from Campaign for North Africa, that's the kind of crap that an actual logistics officer really does care about and really has to manage. That saying that you're putting realistic logistics into a war game, man, half the time, like the stuff that they've got people chasing around trying to do is stuff that you would never actually have to chase around and do. And the things that I did spend my time dealing with as a battalion maintenance officer or as a log officer, those kinds of things are never anywhere close to being found in one of the computer games anywhere. You know, the emergency resupply that lives at the combat trains, are you going to pack one tank heavy Hemet, one tank only Hemet, and one mech heavy Hemet? Or are you going to pack three of them as tank heavy, you know, so the ammo for two tank platoons and one mech platoon? You know, are you going to match them one to one for the companies that are out there in the field? What happens if your one tank heavy, your tank exclusive Hemet gets blown up? You've just lost half of your tank ammo instead of spreading your tank ammo around to make it a little more survivable. You know, again, this comes back to these are different tips of the trade that you've got to assess when you're actually on the ground having to deal with these things. You know, how are you going to load your emergency resupply? Where are you going to haul all of your barrier materials so that when your engineers decide they're going to start building wire and mine obstacles, where's all the wire and mines actually being stored? Like, you've got all these trucks to move stuff around, but what are you putting on them? Well, I got my ammo, I got my fuel. Where are the wire and mines, right? That stuff takes up a lot of space. Where are you putting it? What's the level of realism you really want in there?
So. You don't. you going over it, saying that's not any fun. You know? Yeah. And it just needs to be simplified, you know?
Yeah.
You have these elements in the games, but there's no reason to get, you know, that specific.
Well, and Brian, you will appreciate this as well, just because you've actually seen it in action some. The talk that I did at the Winter ACDC back in January about why you don't want realistic logistics in war games, I used the World at War 85 series as the example, mainly because I had the graphics on already available on the computer for it. Just the space all that shit takes up on the battlefield, right? You've got counters out there for all your tank platoons and for a couple of headquarters dudes, a couple of infantry dismounts. You've got your mortar section rolling around out there, right? But what don't you have on the map? You don't have your combat trains command post. You don't have your field trains command post. You don't have your unit maintenance collection point. You don't have any of your casualty collection points. You don't have your ambulance exchange point. You don't have your main supply route marked off that you can't use for reinforcements because otherwise it's going to get in the way of all those logistics trucks we were just talking about. You don't have your ambulance, your actual casualty evacuation routes. And oh, by the way, you never designated your dirty routes for when your unit gets slimed with chemical stuff so that you're not now contaminating your MSR. You're bringing them to a decon site on a completely different road that you're keeping clear just for slimed units. How much space did we just take away from the map by putting all of that shit out there?
Right.
Right. Now you just ran out of real estate to move around. Never mind if you're actually trying to fight a mobile defense that is intended to withdraw along the way. So, you know, at some point, this whole realism in war games canard needs to just be drop kicked.
I think one of the better computer games I've seen handle supply, in my opinion, is Advanced Tactics by Vic. It's the same guy that does the Barbarossa stuff.
I've never
played those games. I'm assuming the supply would work the same there because it's kind of, you know, supply flows along points to your front lines from the back lines, and you've got to keep those lines open.
It does. What was the last one? The Barbarossa one is the last one I played.
The Barbarossa, yeah.
And yes, I had no very well displayed. You know what's going on. You know, you don't get to the point where units are just running out of supply and you have no idea why. Just a pet peeve of mine in some games where, but yeah, it's very well done.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and you also, you know, along the way, and this is especially true with the board games, but can sometimes be true of the computer games. Like those supply convoys never get lost.
Right? This is true.
You know, the ambush of the 507th Maintenance Company in Nasiriyah in Iraq never happens in any war game because some idiot lieutenant was reading the map upside down. That shit never happens in a war game. You know,
it's so and it's an old Matrix game, computer game. It's a Forge of Freedom.
Yep.
Which you had Civil War, and it would break down into tactical battles, and there were supply wagons, and you could issue an order and say, okay, I want you to move, you know, 3 hexes this way towards the troops, and one of the outcomes was it misinterpreted the order and go off totally the opposite direction from what you wanted. So you kind of had
cool,
that.
That's cool, though. I mean, that's good.
But you know what? Forge of Freedom was one of those games I'm talking about where they got a little too detailed for its own good. You know, that was one of those games where you're choosing whether to buy Spencer rifles or Sharps rifles, stuff like that.
But see, the beauty of that game, though, was you could set the level of detail. If you didn't want to do that, you could play the basic game or you could,
well, the
you
could yes, I understand
customize
that,
it.
But the question is, was the AI doing anything effectively when you gave, you know, gave
and
over
so,
to it?
And so, and Brant's heard me say this a million times, that's why I would play a game like that in a hot seat solo. I would control both sides.
Yeah, because then if Mike cheats to win, he's only got himself to blame.
That's right. And I win. And I lose. Yeah.
And you know, this almost every, you know, Hearts of Iron, Europa Universalis, all these games with Paradox, whenever they come up with another expansion, and, you know, they love their expansions because their whole business model is based on, you know, selling the expansions.
So that's Thursdays, basically.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
right.
So as soon as I see it, I just cringe because I'm like, oh, no, what rules is it adding? What's it adding that the AI is going to have no idea what it's doing? You know?
What's it breaking this time?
Exactly. I just cringe.
Somebody much, much more knowledgeable of the Paradox games than me once said that they're pretty confident that when Paradox tests each expansion, what they do is they test that expansion with the base game, and they just kind of hope that it works with all the other expansions. It seems to be the that seems to be the release plan, because the problem is once you have five expansions, like you tested A with the base game, you tested B with the base game, you might have tested B with A. By the time C comes around, you tested C with A and B, and you tested C with the base game. But you didn't test C with just A, and you didn't test C with just B. By the time you get to D, there ain't no way in hell you're working on all those permutations. Like, D works with the base game. It might work with everything else. Great. Go for it. People send us the bug reports themselves. And by the time you get to E, F, G, and H, it's just sort of launch and pray.
Well, I think that's one of the complaints that Martok had about Stellaris in the forums, that it's, you know, Stellaris now is nothing like the game that launched. It's so different. It's...
I've read that.
But was he actually complaining about that, or was he like, you know, it's SC about play, time they turned it into a good game, you know?
Yeah.
So I think that that argument sort of cut both ways. One was, yeah, it's a completely different game from how it launched, but it's actually complete and tested and viable at this point.
Well, see, that's fallen Enchantress from Brad Wardall and
that one's come up a few times in the discussion as well. Just so we're clear, we're talking about Stellaris, the computer game, not the recently kickstarted board game coming from Konami. Yeah,
got to put out your board game,
which I did not order. So there's
neither did Vance. And Vance is already regretting it.
And let me
by the time this podcast releases, Vance will have caved.
Let me give a quick review of the latest Paradox game. Well, I don't know if it's the latest. Crusader Kings 3 is out, and I finally broke down and bought it and gave it a playthrough, and I've already uninstalled it. I just you've done it before. You've played it before. It's pretty much the same thing with a snazzy new interface, which is really nice. But, you know, you're basically, once your king dies, you want your son to inherit your kingdom, and you just kind of do the same thing over and over and over and over again, you know? So your king dies, son inherits, rinse and repeat.
That's like one of their most popular games, though, isn't it?
It is. And, you know, I just cannot get into it. I'm playing as Ireland right now. I formed the Kingdom of Ireland, okay? I have my vassals. I'm the king. All right. Now what am I supposed to do, you know? It's just not all that challenging. You know, there's not enough thrown at you to keep it interesting, so to speak.
It's like the computer game The Sims. It's like, okay, I'm waking up now, making breakfast, okay, and I'm going to work. And you're like, this is what I do. Why am I playing a game?
Well,
that
goes back to what's the difference between a game and a sim. And we're making fun of the – not intending the double entendre there, but – that is a high fidelity model of a, you know, or an attempt at a high fidelity model of a real world, but with no actual competitive objectives overlaid on it, then it's not much of a game to it. It's sort of a toy. You know, that's what Will Wright always said about SimCity. SimCity is a toy. You know, it's not necessarily a game until you actually overlay any specific objectives onto it that says, okay, you have to build a pollution-free city, or you have to build a Godzilla-proof city, or whatever it might be. So,
I mean, I could obviously try to go, you know, take on Scotland or something like that, but it just wasn't doing it for me.
Yeah.
Well, there's got to be a Game of Thrones mod you could find that would.
Yes.
Here's the problem, though. Once you take over Scotland, like, you've got Scotland. Like, now what?
Well, then you got to go take over England. The whole part, the thing about the game is there's so many layers to it. I'll give it that. As far as hereditary rule and so forth, you know, making sure that your kingdom isn't split up three ways between your kids, you know, stuff like that. That is actually a game within itself, but it's only interesting to a certain point. Yeah.
It was interesting to Charlemagne. he could have used a trial run through Crusader Kings there before his whole thing fell apart.
Well, you know, I got sick of, you know, I'd have three kids and then my kingdom that I'd worked for would get split up three ways. I got sick of that. So basically I just gained the system, and there's a button that lets you disinherit the kids. So I would leave one to, you know, inherit the kingdom. The other two, you disinherit.
Yeah. Good luck.
Yeah.
New world is that way. Keep sailing west. Let us know what you find.
It's almost like an RPG game to a certain extent. If you could really, you know, make up your own stories kind of as you go along, you know, put your own, you know, imagination to it. Probably a more entertaining game.
I think you'd have to play it that way. Yeah.
Yep. Guys, we're running close to the 90-minute mark as we are recording this. By the time I edit out me saying too many times, we'll probably lose 15 minutes.
Take that.
So we do need to pull the plug on tonight. But Brian, this has been fun. Let's not wait 6 years to have you on another episode of the podcast, right?
Yeah, it's been great. Great talking to you guys.
So definitely want to do that again. And so by the time this podcast is out, Connections Online will be in our rearview mirror. So for folks that were able to join us for that, thanks a lot. For folks that didn't, like, totally get it, because this is something very different than what we normally do. This is the professional game conference for practitioners that are doing wargaming in a serious games kind of environment, like for the DoD or think tanks, people like that. If you know, that's your jam, great. You can still watch a whole lot of those presentations on YouTube, and we've got them all linked to our site where you can find it there. But if you're just looking for some war games to play, it's actually Father's Day weekend in June is when Origins was supposed to have been held in the summer, when Origins moved out of that and moved to October for their in-person convention. We parked our ACDC on that weekend because you were planning on playing war games with us anyway, right? You're just going to do it at the computer in your office at home instead of joining us in Ohio. And hopefully next summer we can all reconvene in Ohio, and we might even be able to talk Brian into making an appearance that year. You better, damn it. All right. Brian, thanks very much for joining us. Really appreciate you being here.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun.
And Mike, appreciate you being able to come back again, and, you know, let's do all this again in a week or so.
Anytime. And Brian, it was good talking with you.
Good talking to you, sir.
Cool, guys. All right, audience, thank you very much for indulging us on this sort of, you know, rather agendaless romp through the world of wargaming. We hope you had a good time too, and we'll talk to you next time on another episode of Mention and Dispatches.